Okay, thanks. I actually wanted to start do something that really isn't part of my what I was planning on talking about. But since David did the action potential, I want to just show you a little model of a Hodgkin-Huxley type action potential propagating along an axon. So on the top there is the axon. So this is solving the complete two-dimensional differential equation of x and t, not the space clamp version. And it's being done on a computer by compartmentalizing. So all those lines, that's supposed to represent a long tube, in other words, an axon. But all the lines just represent making space discrete so that the computer can deal with the differential equation as a difference equation, of course. And then there are very efficient methods for solving this, but this is just exactly the equations that David wrote down being integrated by a computer, and I'll run it for a second, but let me just say what the setup is. You see the green triangle way there on the left? This is a pointer, right? That's a site of current injection. So this would resemble somebody who had dissected out a squid axon in the lab and then was injecting some current into the axon at this point. And then I'll just run it and you can see what happens. It shouldn't surprise you, but it's kind of just nice to see one go. So what you can see is because a continual DC current is being injected there, action potentials are periodically being generated at the beginning of the axon, and then there they go. They propagate down. They look just like the time pictures that David shown, only flipped around, right? Because time is sort of running the other way, but it's really space, right? This is the function of position. So what you're seeing here at any point is the voltage on the axon at that corresponding point. Let me just show you a couple of things, and then I'll move on. But anyway, there they go. And the whole point of the thing is that they propagate. Let me just show you that axons are not unidirectional devices. So what I'm going to do, if I can pull it off here, is just to move my current injection point here to the middle of the axon. So now it's as if you stuck an electrode into the middle of the axon and injected current there. Let me put it right in the middle. Oh, it doesn't matter. I don't seem to be capable of doing that. What you'll see now is that you generate two action potentials that go either way. So axons are perfectly happy to propagate in either direction, and that's often an aggravation to experimentalists because they can't control which way they propagate. They propagate in one direction in natural setting just because neurons tend to stimulate the axon at its beginning. So it's more like the situation I had before. And then the other thing I wanted to show you is why bother. If I can remember how to do this, as I say, I didn't really plan on doing this. I haven't shown this thing for ages. And that is, if I just turn off, so this is the analog of what David was saying of dumping both TEA and TTX in the bath. In other words, taking away all of these active channels that Hodgkin and Huxley studied, and instead looking at a passive cable. And this is exactly, I assume, what David talked to you about yesterday. You get an exponential decay in the voltage. So maybe I never even said what I was plotting here, I'm sorry. This is the voltage on the membrane as a function of position, and you see this exponential decay. So if this was the way this neuron was trying to signal things, you see that no indication, practically nothing gets to the end. I mean, if I'd started in the end, it would be even worse. You can't go more than about fraction of a millimeter or so. I might have mentioned here that this is 4 millimeters long, this cable. So you can't get very far propagating signals without actively doing so. I guess I can stop there. I can show you them colliding and all that. If somebody wants, I can show you afterwards. But there is. Maybe it was hard to see. Let me start one up. It should be at any rate. It's probably better if I start it from one end. So let me run one and just stop it in the middle. So, well, the trouble is that there's another one coming. If the next one didn't come, there would be an undershoot here, and then it would come back. There is some undershoot there. I guess, well, it's a little hard. It's not very big, is it? Yeah. There is, at any rate. I think it's partly because the next one's coming along too soon, so it's cutting it off. Okay, so as I said, that's not really what I'm talking about. In fact, I'm not even going to use this computer for the time being, so let me put it to sleep. And will that thing turn itself off, or maybe somebody can figure out how to turn that thing off? Or just stick something in the front of it, yeah? All right, so let me just give an outline. You know, since the morning started with action potentials, let me give a quick outline of what I'm really going to talk about and then get into it. We'll be back to that in a second. So, a thing I think that fascinates everybody in neuroscience is the fact that neurons, because they have to propagate, I mean, a neuron's whole purpose really is to propagate a signal from one part of the body or one part of the brain to another. So in doing so, they have to propagate essentially soliton-type waves. So you saw that pulse, I'm not drawing it very well, going along the axon. You can actually prove mathematically, or it has been proven mathematically, that independent of initial conditions, there's only one waveform that propagates with these equations down, asymptotically down a cable. So the shape of this action potential is completely stereotyped. No matter how I wiggled the end of that cable, by the other end, the same action potential will come out every time. And therefore, the only thing that you're left with in signaling is the timing of these action potentials. The voltage waveform is just a stereotyped thing that doesn't do anything, doesn't tell you anything about the signal. So basically, we have a transformation here. I'll try to write it over here. That you have some signal coming in to the neuron. It might be a stimulus out in the world or whatever the particular neuron is reacting to. And as a function of time, you know, it's wiggling around, doing whatever it is. And the neuron, because it has to propagate that signal to a distant site, changes that into a sequence of discrete events called action potentials. Those are the spikes that we talked about. And it, in a sense, digitizes the signal as far as voltage goes. I mean, there's just an on-off signal. Either you have one or you won't. And turns it into a code where time is everything. Okay, it's only the timing of these action potentials. You can't make a little bit bigger action potential here to signal that the stimulus was high and make a smaller action potential here. You can't do that. All you can do is fiddle with the timing of these spikes. And this transformation from a continuous signal to a timing-based on-off digital signal is really the subject of neural coding, which is a huge part of neuroscience, and it's a fascinating subject. I'll talk some about that, but in a way, one of the ways to deal with this is to go back to a continuous signal. In other words, come back and try to reconstruct a description of the spike train that is more similar to the original stimulus. And that is usually what's called a firing rate. So from this discrete signal, we'll generate another signal that's continuous. And then we can talk about, for example, the transformation from there to there. So I'm going to talk about these various pieces. I'll initially talk about this transformation from a continuous signal into these discrete spike train events. Then I want to talk about how from those spike train events you would define a firing rate and go back to a continuous description of the response. And then I want to talk about how do you get from here to here? How do you model a transformation from the stimulus to the response characterized as a firing rate? And maybe we'll talk a little bit about, on the way, why wouldn't you want to just model directly in terms of spikes? Why do you want to do this end run, sort of? And then finally, I'll talk about, and this will lead into Sebastian Sung's talks, modeling circuits on the basis of these kinds of variables. Okay, so that's the general outline. Please ask questions throughout. Interrupt me, yell at me if I'm tied up with the computer and all this stuff, you know, I'm going to be tied up and busy. So just yell it out. I'll try to stop and take questions, but please, you know, I'm going to be talking a long time. You're going to be sick of it. I'm going to be sick of it if you don't interrupt me every once in a while. Okay, so what really I think excites a lot of people in neuroscience is kind of characterized by this picture. I really wanted to start with it, even though kind of a hodgepodge. Because in a way, you know, if you want to ponder the mysteries of the brain, this isn't a bad place to start. This is a spike train, obviously. Each line here represents an action potential generated by a neuron. I'll tell you what the neuron was and what was going on, but let me just tell you how to read it first. This reads like a book. If, for those of you familiar with the neuroscience, this is not a raster. I'll tell you what that is in a second. In other words, this top line is the first 5 seconds of data. So every line is 5 seconds of data. I'm going to be flapping in the breeze here. And the next line is the next 5 seconds, the next is the next 5 seconds. So you're being shown, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20, however many seconds in the life of this neuron. And this neuron is recorded from the brain of a monkey, and the monkey was watching TV, actually, during this recording. This was done in Edmonds Rawls' lab. I won't bother to tell you why, when I was there, we wanted the monkeys to watch TV. But the monkey's just doing what you might do tonight after I've, you know, exhausted you and David's exhausted you with lectures. And there'll probably be some neurons in your brain doing more or less this. This brain, this is a neuron high in the visual system. Maybe I'll tell you in a second where it comes from. But the point is that this really is all you get in your brain, multiplied by thousands, millions. Neurons are doing this, and from this, everything has to flow from this pattern of spikes, which, as you can see, is highly structured. Everything has to emerge. In particular, in this case, high-level vision has to emerge. Let me talk to you a little bit about this neuron, and I don't know, just get you a feel for, in a sense, I want to start by just giving you a feel for the what's called systems neuroscience. So this isn't a monkey brain, this is a human brain, but I can show you roughly where. This neuron is right in here somewhere. And it's in a very late stage of the visual system. So this is the front of the brain, the back of the brain. The visual system kind of works in a funny manner in the sense that your eyes are, of course, on the front of your head, but vision starts at the back of your head. So primary visual cortex, which I talk about, is right in the back of your head. And then the visual signal moves forward from that point along roughly two pathways. One going down the temporal lobe like this, and one kind of going over the top of your head is another pathway. And those are generally, I mean, of course I'm simplifying, but those are generally thought to be responsible for pattern recognition, object recognition, this pathway, the temporal pathway, and so for identifying complex objects in the world, whereas the other pathway, this one, which I'll talk about a little bit too, is more responsible for tracking objects, for being able to reach objects, let's say, being able to duck if somebody throws something at you, that sort of visual discrimination, spatial vision discrimination. Anyway, this is a cell way down in this part of the brain, and this particular neuron, in fact, is a highly specialized visual neuron. It's selective for faces, either human or monkey faces, probably because of these monkeys live in, of course, a very human-dominated environment. They're not out there in the jungle. They will respond to faces. And if I could show you the video at the same time, you know, I would guess probably along in here somebody stuck their face into the video. Or this was a video I think we made, but later after I left, they started showing soap operas to these poor monkeys. And so it correlates pretty well with that. Let me mention something that has nothing to do with my talk, but it's an incredibly fascinating thing about these neurons. When we did this experiment, you know, we wanted to look at the statistics of how neurons respond, you know, kind of in everyday life or whatever, if you can call watching TV in everyday life of a monkey. But so we looked at the spike train, we computed various statistical measures of what it's doing. It's clearly complicated, right? It has a very sort of bursty structure, long periods when almost nothing happens, and then very high frequency firing. And then we figured, okay, well, it's an experiment, you need a control, you know? So we turned off the TV and then had the monkey look at a blank screen. And the picture looks almost the same. If I showed you a monkey looking at a blank screen, almost nothing would change in this picture. There'd be a few less spikes, but the basic structure would be the same. So then he said, oh, let's turn off the light. So you sit the monkey in the dark, and the thing looks exactly the same. A few less spikes again. So then you might say, well, this neuron has nothing to do with the TV set. But you go back and you look and you see, no, absolutely, when that happened, a face came on. You can correlate it, no problem. And so you discover thought, right, this way. In other words, neurons in your brain are always occupied by something, and in monkeys' brains too, and they can flip from being very driven by external influences to being very internally driven. And I think really one of the mysteries is how do they do that? So I just throw that out for you to ponder. I don't know the answer to it. So in Edmonds Rawls' lab, they study these neurons, so they know where...
How did you find this neuron?
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's what I was asking. So in Edmonds, yeah, how was that? I would believe it or not, I was actually answering that. They study these neurons regularly, and basically, the first person to study, I think, it was in Charlie Gross's lab, was just kind of poking around. So typically in these kinds of experiments, if you've never been in that region of brain before, you record from a neuron and you start doing things, and you see what makes the neuron fire. So you stand in front of the monkey and you do this, and you hold up this, and you hold up that. And literally, there's a researcher named Tanaka in Japan who goes into these regions and literally holds up every object he can think of until he sees what the neuron responds to. It can be very difficult, especially in the late regions of the brain, where these neurons correlate with a lot of things. It can be very difficult to figure out what they're responding to. So anyway, that's how it was discovered. But once you know where they are, then you can regularly find them. So they knew where they were, and they just go back and find them over and over again. Okay, I want to talk one thing about these recordings, and then I'll show you a whole bunch of them. So what I was showing you, this kind of thing, of course this isn't the raw experimental data, but it's extracted from that, is what's called an extracellular recording. So an electrode has been put into the monkey's brain and located near a cell. Sort of, you can think of it as sitting right next to the neuron, but it's not inside the neuron. It hasn't penetrated the neuron. If it did penetrate the neuron would die, so that would be a bad idea. And as a result, what it's sensitive to, it's sort of capacitively coupled to the neuron, and it can sense these rapid voltage transients. So here are some action potentials recorded intracellularly, so where you really know the membrane potential in the cell. So all you get in these extracellular recordings is the locations of these action potentials. What you don't see is this what's called subthreshold stuff that you would see if you could penetrate the cell and get an electrode into the cell. Now that can be done in a living animal, but it's extraordinarily difficult. And so most of the recordings done in living animals are these extracellular recordings, where all you get is the timing of the action potentials. But since that really is the code, as far as neural signaling goes, you haven't lost that much. What you've lost is understanding the biophysics. So intracellular recordings are extremely important if you really want to know mechanistically what's going on. But if you just want to see the signal, an extracellular recording will do the trick. And let me bring my brain. Okay, so I wanted to show you a bunch of examples. This is my lightning tour of neuroscience. And since the visual system, I'm going to talk a lot about the visual system. I thought I would give this example. I like this example very much. I'm not going to go through. This is the retina. But the retina is an example of the fact that, in a sense, evolution was made aware of the fact that in doing this transformation from a continuous signal to a series of discrete events, you lose a lot, right? It's if you look, for example, digital TV compared to analog TV, you have to send a huge amount of information to compensate for the fact that you're just giving bits instead of a continuous signal. So, and in fact, there's evidence in biology that if neurons can avoid doing this, they do. And the retina is a very nice example of that. There are entire animals, small worms called C. elegans, that live their whole life without ever firing one of these action potentials. And the reason is that they're only millimeter long. So if you only have to signal over sub-millimeter type length scales, you don't need to do action potentials. So action potentials are sort of also the price of being big. And within our own retinas, the nervous system takes advantage of that. Within the retina, which is, of course, a very thin layer on the back of your eye, you can do perfectly well by having continuous voltage signals in response to the light. But if you want to get that signal from the eye to the brain, which of course is many millimeters, then you've got to turn it into these action potentials. And this is just a picture of the eye. These are the photosensitive rods and cones, photodetectors. And then there's a series of three layers, really. There are the photoreceptors, bipolar cells, retinal ganglion cells, and then two layers of interconnecting cells, horizontal cells and amacrine cells. And at the early stages, if you flash a light, what you see is the voltage just makes a continuous change. There are no action potentials. It just reflects the intensity of the light in the magnitude of that voltage fluctuation. And that occurs over the initial stages of the retina. But as you get to this output stage, where now the optic nerve, which is the axons of these retinal ganglion cells, has to go to the brain, then it gets changed to action potential. So you actually see this transformation occurring over layers of cells. Within the retina. And as I say, the nervous system, and if it can get away without having to do this transformation, it does it. But over any appreciable distances in the nervous system, things have to go that way. Okay, let me give you, again, just a lightning review of the visual pathway, because we'll need this later, and then we'll go. So I talked a little bit about this, but signals come from the retina, from your eye. Those axons of the retinal ganglion cells project to the thalamus, to a region called the lateral geniculate nucleus, LGN, a region of the thalamus, where they're relayed to the primary visual cortex, which, as I mentioned, is right in the back of your head. Every once in a while, the nervous system, the awesomeness of the nervous system sort of just pops out. And one of the awesome features of the nervous system is we're, of course, completely unaware of anything weird going on in the middle of our visual field. In fact, that's where we see the best. And yet, if you look at how the visual world is portrayed in your primary visual cortex, the fovea on one side, so from the middle to this side, I guess we're upside down. I'll never get the left and right doing this. But anyway, from the middle out is mapped continuously like that. And then on the other side, from the middle out, is like that. So the part of the visual field, when you're working in the middle of the field, is split between that part of the brain and that part of the brain, as far apart as you can get in the primary visual cortex. And yet, you're completely unaware that you're continually flipping from one side of the brain to the other when you wiggle your finger around like that. That also has nothing to do with my talk, but it's kind of an interesting thing. Okay, so I want to give you a tour. So, you know, what people do, in particular, you know, study responsive neurons in their brains, they stick their electrode, you know, they stick it in here, 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 and you know, they have the animal do various things or look at various things if it's in the visual system and see what happens. And I just want to give you a lightning tour of some of that, because we're going to talk about models of this on two different levels, actually. So this is some of the early work. This is this classic Hubel and Wiesel type experiment, on which they realize, this is done in a cat, that one of the effective stimuli. So when you do this, you know, what you have to do, you find a neuron. The first thing you have to do is get it to fire. So you have to find a stimulus which makes it fire. And that's often not easy. It wasn't even easy for Hubel and Wiesel, but eventually they discovered that if they put either light or dark bars in the visual field and move them across, they could get these cells to respond quite effectively. And what this shows is two of the kinds of selectivities. So after you get the neuron to respond, then you try to figure out what is it selective to? What makes its response change? And in this case, what's making the response change is, one, the orientation of the bar. So you can see as they tip the bar here, they get fewer and fewer spikes. And this is what the raw data looks like, actually, off an electrode. Each of the lines is an action potential. It appears as both an up and down swing, because since it's capacitively coupled, you're effectively looking at the derivative of the voltage. So you see the upswing and the downswing. Anyway, you can see that it's orientation selective, and you can also see that it's directionally selective. So if they move the bar upward, they get that. If they move it the other way, they get almost nothing. So you start to map out the selectivities of these neurons. And now you start to immediately see the problem that faces neuroscience modeler, experimentalist modelers, all of us, in that spikes are a complicated response, right? This is a very complex pattern of action potentials that were generated by that bar. Furthermore, if they did the sweep again, that isn't shown here, but I'll show it to you in a second, they wouldn't get the same pattern of spikes. So you have to figure out how you're going to describe this complex and variable response. And one of the easiest ways is just to count all the spikes, for example. Or count the spikes and divide by the amount of time that the spikes occupied, which gives you a firing rate. And if you do that, you start to get one of the classic ways of showing selectivities of neurons. You start to get what are called response tuning curves. So this is the average firing rate of the cell. In other words, count the spikes divided by the duration of the response. Average it over a bunch of trials so that you get rid of some of the variability. And you can see that you get a curve where as you tip the bar, so what's on the x-axis here is the orientation of the bar, as you tip the bar, you get a kind of a tuned response to the bar. And you can say that this is an orientation-tuned cell. Here, 0 degrees has been defined to be the best orientation. And so this is done over and over again in many different experiments, and that's just sort of to show you a little of the variety of it. So, for example, this is a cell from a little later in the visual system. Where's my brain? Let's see if I can find it. There it is. So this is an area located in here. It's actually probably best to think of it as part of this parietal pathway, the motion position pathway. And these are cells that are selective to moving visual scenes. So this is a plot of moving a pattern of dots on a screen at different angles. So this circle represents the direction of motion of the visual scene. And you can see here's a plot of actually, these are histograms, these are raw data. This is a plot of the firing rate or the number of spikes you got as a function of time in different directions. And you can see that this is tuned for the direction of a moving stimulus. So you start to map out that. And each of these regions, each picture I'm showing you is like being studied for years and years and years. Here's a neuron, for example, that, as you go down, this is back in the inferior temporal cortex where I started. This is, again, a face selective neuron like I showed you at the beginning. And this is showing, for example, that this is selective to the orientation of the face, how the face is turned relative to the monkey. So that's the name of the game in neural coding. Yeah. What they'll tend, for example, these are highly specialized, not to give much of a response in response to other things. But they might be, their weak response, if you can measure it enough, it might be orientation selective too, yeah. They tend to be fairly, well, this is late in the visual system. Neurons tend to be fairly broadly tuned, not highly, highly selective, but these are among the most selective in the visual system, these particular cells. Okay. Let me give you one more example. I guess I have a couple more examples. I don't want to bore you with this, but this is neuroscience, basically, mapping out these sorts of responses. So this is an interesting example. This is a cell from the hippocampus of a rat. Hippocampus is, a region sort of tucked under the temporal lobe. It's actually not a neocortex region. It's a slightly different kind of brain area. But these are cells that are sensitive to location. So each box here represents a box in which a rat is running around. So the boxes are just repeated. Think of every box as being the box where the rat is going around. And then every different box represents a different neuron that's been recorded. And the color coding shows how rapidly that neuron was firing at different portions of the box. And you can see that these neurons are selective to where the animal is in the box. Okay, they have a response, what's called a receptive field, that's anchored to the box, and therefore could be used as a coding system for the animal to figure out where it is in its environment, for example. And just to give fair practice to the motor system, on the motor side, things are similar, only of course it's not going to be a stimulus that correlates with the firing rate, but a motor action. And this is an example of neurons firing when an animal was reaching in different directions. So the animal was holding a manipulandum and was instructed to reach to the left, reach to the right, reach forward, etc. And then here, these are actually, the spike rasters. And this is a raster. So what this represents is different trials when the animal made the same motion. And you can see some of the variability that exists from trial to trial. But you can see that this neuron clearly is, responds best when the animal makes a leftward motion of its arm and less when it makes a rightward motion. Okay, so the name of the game in neural coding is to figure out somehow the correlation between the spiking patterns and whatever either the animal is doing if it's a motor side, or whatever the animal is experiencing if it's on the sensory side. Now, I mentioned the concept of a firing rate. I mean, one of the best ways to go about simplifying this is to think of the thing statistically. Okay, so. Let me belabor this slightly. I think I'm going to go through this in the coding because this is sort of a highly debated area. So these are, again, recordings from this area MT. This is the motion selective area in the visual pathway. And these are actually, there's a long study in the literature of variability of responses, and which was effectively the result of an accident. You know, people want to get on with their experiments, and they don't want to show the same stimulus over and over again to an animal. They want to try different things. And so you tend to not have a huge amount in the literature of repetitions of the identical stimulus. But of course, if you want to look at variability, you want to see the same stimulus shown over and over again. But fortunately, these people screwed up their random number generator. And so, unknowns to them, they repeated the same stimulus over and over again until they finally realized what was going on. But they accumulated a lot of statistics on repeated stimuli, which they've then cashed in on very nice papers. This is from the Newsom lab on variability. Okay, so what you're seeing here again is rasters. So each dot here is a spike. What you're seeing is a pattern of random dots on the screen, or what the monkey was seeing, which is moving in some direction. And the difference between these three plots is essentially how complex the pattern of dots was. I guess, David, maybe you talked a little bit about this Newsom experiment, right? The random dots. Anyway, yeah. I won't beat it to death. And you know, again, these are the responses over I don't know how many trials. You can try to count the lines, but many, many trials. You can see a great deal of variability. And you know, you're faced with trying to describe that response, clearly trying to build a model by which you were told the stimulus and you were going to predict every single dot on this page is a daunting task. It's not even clear it would be an intelligent thing to do, because you know, why should your model be any less variable, let's say, than the animal is variable? So it's a highly variable response. So it's clear that a model of this is going to have to be a statistical model. You're never going to count for every spike, and you're never going to have a model say that, yes, I knew that spike was going to occur. Forget it. So you want some sort of statistics, and of course the easiest statistic is the probability per unit time of a spike occurring. So the probability that in a little unit time delta t, you'll get a spike. And by that, you mean averaged over trials. So you say, okay, let me draw a little bin here somewhere in the middle of the trace and say, what's the probability I would have found a spike on any given trial in that bin? And that's what's accumulated here. They've chosen some relatively narrow bin sites here, and they've plotted this running probability, which is what I want to call the firing rate. Some people call it I like to call it the time-dependent firing rate. Some people call it an instantaneous firing rate, which whenever I hear, I always think like Heisenberg would be rolling in his grave to hear such a word. But so I don't like to call it the instantaneous firing rate, but I know what they mean. Anyway, so here it is, and it has different forms for the different stimuli and like that. And almost everything I'm going to talk about is going to be about these beasts, okay? In other words, we're going to characterize the response in terms of this wiggly line, the top of the black mountains, and not the spikes. If I have time, maybe I'll try to go for how you might get back from that wiggly line back to the spikes, but we're essentially going to go there. And now you have a much easier problem. For one thing, you now have more or less a deterministic description. In other words, if you average over enough trials, the same thing's going to happen here. And you also have a map from a continuous variable to a continuous variable. Namely, again, from this wiggly stimulus to this wiggly line. And not from a continuous variable to this discrete variable. So it makes the problem much easier. And that's mostly what I'm going to talk about. And it's really mostly how neurons are characterized. In 9 papers out of 10 or something, you'll see the response characterized in terms of these firing rates. Yeah, Dave. Yeah, I don't know if this data is big enough. The variability is very large. So, of course, I'm talking about in the n equals infinity, and then it would have to by definition. For this data, I doubt it. I mean, all of these little wiggles wouldn't. This general shape would. I don't know what's going on here, to tell you the truth, but there's maybe a little locking. So I wouldn't be surprised if those two peaks were, and maybe that, you know, obviously not the little wiggles, but... tomorrow, you know, yeah, on that scale, not every little wiggle, and probably in this area, yeah. I'll tell you, what I would suspect would mostly go down is the overall level, because animals get tired, they get more excitable, and what tends to happen is this graph will go up and down. But the general shape, yeah, I would say so. But, you know, it depends on how much the animal's paying attention. Obviously, animals are variable beasts.
Right.
So let's go to, I think that's where I'm going. So, yeah. So what David's starting on is the debate about whether this process throws out large fractions of the information, okay? Clearly, this one number doesn't tell you by any means, not only everything about the spiking pattern, but even anything about the statistics. It's just a first order statistic. For example, it'll tell you the probability that a spike will occur, let's say at this time, but it won't give you any conditional probabilities. For example, well, what's the probability the spike will occur here, given that one occurred here? And so there's a whole argument about whether the neural code might depend on such conditional probabilities. Perhaps, you know, a pattern of spikes where one occurs here and one occurs here means something quite different than just independently a spike occurring here and occurring here. So as David said, that there's an assumption of independence. That firing rate would only give you the whole statistics if every one of these spikes were independent. And we can talk about whether that's true. And furthermore, as David was saying, it's not just this one neuron, of course, that the animal is thinking with, it's many neurons, and you have to ask whether knowing their independent firing rates is sufficient, or do you have to know that not only, you know, this neuron fired, but it was 2 milliseconds after this neuron fired, and therefore maybe the signal is something different. So that this is an argument that rages in the neuroscience community with incredible imprecision. And it's almost degenerated, you know, into people not talking to each other in any meaningful manner. So I'm going to try to give you my assessment. I mean, I can only do this because, like, nobody else is allowed to talk, right? You have people ask. Yeah, that's what you were seeing, right? So here, right, for example. But that's okay, because that could be described by firing rate, because the firing rate can depend on the stimulus. What you couldn't account for is that on one of these trials, let's say if there were a lot of spikes here, you know, it might adapt more. It can't get that kind of thing, the dependence of one spike on another. But just an adaptation. The firing rate doesn't have to be time independent, for example. It can go up and down. So that process you should be able to describe. So. Mm-hmm. Right. Look for the conditional probabilities, in other words. And yeah, so I'll get back to that. Of course, that's exactly the right thing to do. And I'll give you my assessment, and maybe there's somebody around that will argue the other case. I feel almost guilty, you know, to have nobody here that will say, wait a minute. But maybe you all will. Good. Okay, so the thing is that, you know, this argument is often phrased as, does timing matter? Well, that's a stupid question in neuroscience. Of course, timing is the only thing an action potential has. Of course timing matters. I think that the question is, timing relative to what? I think that's the question that's being asked. And you can say, okay, there's a lot of things that timing could be relative to. For example, perhaps it's relative to other action potentials. Okay? Now, I'm not responsible for this muck, but I just told you that a firing rate is really a description where the reaction potential is independent. Nevertheless, I think people who would think of a code in which the timing is relative to other action potentials would call that a rate code. It's a lousy use of the language, but nevertheless it's true. It really should be called perhaps an ISI code or something, where the interspike intervals are the relevant thing in the coding. Nevertheless, I think that roughly would fall into what people call a rate code. So one thing you got to think of if you read the literature, the debate over this, is what people call rate code doesn't have a whole lot to do with firing rates. It just has to do with a historical concept of what they mean. On the other hand, if you say, no, it's the timing of the spikes relative to the stimulus that counts, then that would be what people tend to call a temporal code, although they tend to only call it a temporal code if that's quite a precise correlation, which it kind of almost always is. So anyway, those are the words that people pass around, even though to me the whole thing is backwards, that in fact if single spike times relative to the stimulus count, that really is the case where the time-dependent probability of firing is the relevant variable. So that's one reason that the thing is a muck, because these words have not been applied really in a very rigorous manner. So let me tell you the answer. I mean, I think it's clear that the most information by far in the neural code is indeed the timing of these spikes relative to the stimulus. Period. I don't think that would even be debated, even by the most rabid, probably would. Anything I say would be debated by somebody. But anyway, according to me, it indeed is the timing of the spikes relative to the stimulus that is the key thing. And despite the fact that that's usually argued as evidence against a rate code, it's actually very good evidence that a firing rate is a good description, because a firing rate tells you the probability that that spike would have occurred relative to the stimulus. It's what I said in answer to your question. Firing rates characterize the response relative to the stimulus. They just don't characterize very well the response relative to other spikes. Yeah?
No, they don't
have to be. Because in principle, and of course there's always the problem of a bin size, but here it's the Institute for Theoretical Physics, so bins, data are always infinite in this building, right? So if you have enough data, you could make your bin size arbitrarily small, and, I guess you can think of this curve as being made of little continuous segments that are flat on top, but you can make that as close to a continuous curve as you want if you have enough data. So that's more of a practical matter, and I'm thinking ideally that you have so much data that you really could construct this curve as virtually as a continuous curve. So, okay, I think you're using the definition of firing rate. I mean, this is partly what is involved with this confusion. If you think of a firing rate as being defined by summing spikes over discrete time, like 500 milliseconds, and then dividing by that time, then you're absolutely correct, because if you're binning over 500 milliseconds, you can't talk about variations any faster than that. But I'm talking about a firing rate that's constructed from very, very narrow bins and huge quantities of data. And so it really is very close to a continuous function of time. And then you can talk about the relation between, any arbitrary function here that's wiggling away and any arbitrary function here that's wiggling away. In practice, there's always a limit, of course, but I'm imagining a case where the firing rate is defined or... In this one?
Yeah,
so for example, maybe this would be the orientation of a bar. If we were doing... it's doing this, for example. It could, I've been vague about it. This could be the pitch of a sound if it was an auditory neuron. Whatever the neuron is responding to. So I haven't specified it, but... And I'll give you some examples. Okay, so anyway... I think a more interesting issue, as again, it's the same question, timing relative to what, occurs between neurons. So maybe, let me go back to this. And I give you a sociological. So, you can always tell science is degenerated when it's gone into a sociological issue. And this debate really has become a sociological debate, not a scientific debate in the literature, unfortunately. But so let me come back to this. The question is, how much information is contained in just knowing when each spike independently occurred in relation to the stimulus versus knowing other things, like knowing that this spike, was separated from other spikes by various amount. When people have done this analysis, which is quite difficult, so they compute the Shannon information, it requires a lot of data and a very careful analysis, they tend to find that when they include things like neighboring spikes, pairs of spikes, triplets of spikes, they get another 5 or 10% information over what was here. So, and then they always publish it as being evidence for... This is from real data, so it's been done in several systems recently, for example, in cat lateral geniculate nucleus. So they tend to stress, because they want something new, the 5 or 10%. But I would suggest you think about the 90 or 95%, so that there's a lot of evidence that an awful lot of the code from single neurons is really just when is that spike related to the stimulus. And a firing rate description, like I've talked about, will give you that information. Yeah.
Robustness.
You mean? It's robust but slow, right? Because in order to get the message, you've got to integrate over time. And what the nervous system appears to do is on the single neuron level vote for time and then use multiple neurons to get robustness. Because then you can do an integration over space, essentially, over neurons, and get the same information very fast. So you integrate over time by integrating over neurons. So rather than doing this, you do, you know, cross neurons. And that really comes to me, the interesting part of the debate, which also occurs hidden in the sort of rate code, temporal code, blah, is the interesting question, which is there information contained in correlations between neurons? Essentially, the whole thing, I like to call this not rate code and temporal code, but an independent spike code and a correlated spike code. That's really the question. Does each spike act independently to convey information, or do correlations between spikes within a train contain information? So think of it, I like to think of it as independent spike code, correlation-based code. And you can ask the same question at the multi-neuron level. Namely, does each neuron act independently, which would be an independent neuron code, or the correlations between neurons contain information? And this is a much more interesting subject, partly because much less is known about it, and partly because there are some hints that in this case there really might be more significant amounts of information contained in correlations between neurons. Now, I've sort of characterized two kinds of things that could happen. One is in many areas of the brain, actually, the whole population of neurons is involved in rhythmic behavior. So the excitability of the whole region kind of goes up and down over time. And this can be detected by what's called a field potential, so a recording of just the electric field in the neighborhood of neurons, not from any one neuron. And so one way you could have a correlation code is to say, is there any meaning to how these spikes are correlated with that population activity? It essentially, this is like a clocked code, so that you have this clock going on here, and you say, not only when did this spike occur relative to the stimulus is important, but also when did it occur relative to this internal clock, if you want. And then another thing that is argued about a lot is you could just say, well, maybe like you have a couple of neurons or a local population of neurons, and that, for example, if there was a synchronous spike between these pair, maybe that has a different meaning than a spike sort of independently occurring. So this conditional probability contains information. There's a lot of speculation about this, not a whole lot of evidence one way or the other, but there is an example of this, and since I hope I have it in here. Yeah, I do. Let me show it to you. Leave that out. So this is an example, again, from the hippocampus of the rat. So if you remember, there are these neurons that there's a place in the box, and when the rat walks across it, they fire. So it's coding for position. And if you plot the firing rate, or counting spikes, but it's equivalent if you just divide by the integration time, if you plot the firing rate of that neuron as a function of the position in the box, you get this, you know, like a tuning curve, just like what I showed you for orientation, only this is for position. So that obviously the firing rate gives you some information about where the animal is in the box. But what was noticed by O'Keefe and Retschy is that if you correlate the spikes with an ongoing rhythm, so when a rat walks around, there's something called the theta rhythm. Namely, these cells are, as a population, they kind of go up and down in excitability at around 8 to 10 hertz or so. And they looked at the relationship between the timing of the spikes and that population activity and found a correlation. So this tells you where in the phase of this clock rhythm, if you want, each spike occurred as a function of position. And for example, you can see that, you know, in any curve like this, if you know that that the cell's firing at 20 hertz, you don't know whether the animal's on that side or on that side of the place field. This blob is called a place field. But if you look here, if you look at the phase, you can immediately tell the difference between the two sides. So there's clearly some interesting additional information being contained in that correlation of the individual spikes to the phase. And I don't know, Misha Sardix has done some nice modeling on this effect, for example. So
Right.
He didn't get a whole lot. That's exactly right. So what they're talking about, you know, in order to address these things, there's two ways you can go about it. One is to do a Shannon information calculation that's hard, takes a lot of data. Another is to just say, how well can you predict on the basis of these responses, for example, where the animal is? And the work that Dave was talking about, Emery Brown, looked at using only this information to predict where the animal is from multiple cells. Obviously, you can't, you know, it's ambiguous from any one cell. And then adding in this information and didn't get a very dramatic increase. Again, I know. Right. So I agree. I think we can be conservative in this and argue, as most modelers do. I mean, obviously, the easiest thing to do in modeling is to, first of all, think that every spike is independent, and then you don't have to worry about correlations, and then therefore you can use a firing rate. And also to think that every cell is independent, so that you can just sum over cells and do statistics of multiple independent processes. It's obviously much easier. And that simple assumption is still viable. Yeah. Yeah. It did, yes.
So it seems to be that they had a lot of information.
But again, they were using multiple cells. So for example, if you had another cell that had its field over here, that would also resolve the ambiguity, right?
Okay, so the phase information adds little in addition to what you get.
When you use multiple cells, that was the result. And there's actually a contradictory paper from the Lissman group, right? I mean, I don't know the details of these calculations, so I couldn't comment on. But Emery is a very careful, rigorous guy, so I tend to believe him that he didn't get a lot. So anyway, this simple assumption, which of course I will now follow from now on, it seems like an awful simplification, but to be honest with you, currently it cannot be ruled out that to a 90-95% level, which is pretty good in neuroscience, these assumptions are actually okay. A very.
Some people have seen that the brain is an optical machine. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Why would we throw away all this information about correlation? No? There's a lot of information in the correlation.
Right. I mean, I can only guess, or that it's too difficult to generate those correlations, right? That, I mean, it isn't throwing away, it's not clearly there at all. So the question is, and really, when you look at how noisy the brain is, it's incredible. That intracellularly, you know, it takes about 10 millivolts for a neuron to get from as low as it ever sits in voltage to where it fires an action potential. If you look at the random fluctuations, they're in the order of like 5 millivolts in the cortex. So it's just enormous amounts of noise on these signals. So it's not clear that the neuron can generate the correlations. You know, it's optimized with some constraints. And one of the constraints might be that you have to work in a very noisy environment. Now we could argue, why is the brain such a noisy environment? But it really is. So,
they're just negligible, or do you think that it's an addition to the spiking cold and to the firing cold,
right,
and that brain make use of it? Just you can admit it in your analysis.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see why, in a sense, the brain would bother. I mean, measuring these correlations is not so easy. But I can really definitively say why I wouldn't bother. You know, I mean, we don't, we're not at the 5 or 10% level of confusion about the brain. We're at a higher level than that. So I just don't see the point of worrying about the 5 or 10% unless you could show it was really a different kind of information, like information at a higher level or information about intent or, you know, something. But if it's just that I see you a little bit more clearly with that 5 or 10%, really, who cares? Even if the brain uses it or not, we're not at that level to worry about that, I think. The face?
Yeah.
In this plot here that I showed you? So in other words, they've got this oscillating, so they have an electrode picking up this oscillating potential just from the intracellular medium, not from any cell. And then they looked at each spike. So each dot here is a spike, and they just plotted when it occurred on the phase of that oscillating signal. Yeah, and that oscillating signal is being produced by the population as a whole, right?
How does this
oscillate? It's actually generated in another part of the brain, driving this part of the brain. So medial septum, and I mean the biophysics of it. But and really, there's a lot of speculation what it's there for. I mean, maybe it's there for this. Who knows? But it occurs.
And you gave some pretty small evidence, but doesn't that put a pretty lame barrier on how much thinking you can do?
Or got a lot of neurons.
Neumann argument that counts the average firing rate or the maximal firing rate that you can have, and the number of neurons that you can have. There's a problem there, isn't there?
I never did the calculation. Yeah, I got a lot of neurons. The other thing is, so, you know, the good point she's mentioning is that the firing rates are relatively restricted, you know, basically between 0 and 100 hertz, or, you know, neurons can fire faster than that. But in the cortex, you don't get a huge range of firing rates. But individual neurons adapt a lot, so they clearly move their range of selectivity in order to have that 100 hertz range always where the money counts, right? So there's huge amount of adaptation in neurons. That's one mechanism. And the other is you have a lot of neurons. I don't know, I mean, do the calculation. That's a little homework exercise, you know. It's a hard calculation. Clearly, you know, things have got to be combined cleverly. These firing rate variables have to be combined cleverly. This is my personal opinion. I mean, you could easily have this whole talk given by somebody that wouldn't agree with any of this. But I don't think I have distorted the data, at least. Maybe I've interpreted it wrong, but I don't think I've distorted it.
What is the calculation?
Basically just took the number of neurons of and took a reasonable firing rate and then calculated the Shannon information.
And it's summed up. That's going to be a big number. I mean,
it's pretty sad in terms of how much information you can remember or it doesn't seem to explain.
We should look it up. We'll see what the number you got.
The number of atoms that go to a finger are very few compared to the amount of information that we want to process. So when you see that argument, some people argue that there must be some use of correlation because it's not we're not able to go only in the visual system.
So first of all, I'm glad you mentioned it because it's a false argument. Yeah, because they count. It's true that you have many more photoreceptors than you have fibers in the optic nerve. But if you count cones, which is how we're all seeing right now, it's comparable. The ones that you don't match one-to-one are the rods, which are used for night vision. And in night vision, you integrate over many rods just to get the light, and you do have lousy resolution. So, in fact, I really think that argument is wrong. The bottleneck is in changing the signal to spikes in the optic nerve, not in the number of fibers. Then in the end I'm agreeing with you, but I don't know of any. I mean, we should look up this von Neumann calculation to say that this can't possibly work. It would be very interesting to prove such a thing. Okay, so let me just see if I am where I am. When do you want me to stop, Dave?
Why don't we see? Maybe tomorrow.
anybody going to survive if we do that? Can you last that long? Can you last that long? You can go to sleep. Everybody else.
It's got 12:15, 12:30.
Yeah. This. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. No. It's a well belabored point. Of course, but I mean, I'm not saying there are no correlations. The question is, for example, the stimulus itself will cause correlations, right? If I suddenly yell, many of your auditory neurons simultaneously are gonna fire. So it's not that there are no correlations and that'll cause firing. It's whether, you know, there's information, as I said, between spikes that appear to have been independently generated. Yeah, so exactly. I mean, that was the same as what I was saying with him. The firing rate can go up and down, and that will certainly induce correlations into the spike train. So I really mean correlations that cannot be described by the firing rate. I mean, it's kind of circular, I realize, but yeah. From this, I mean, the problem is, it's probably a little, I thought of this while I was saying it, maybe I shouldn't have said this. So it's essentially digitally coded in terms of the amplitude of the signal. It's either on or off. But in terms of the time, that's a continuous variable. So this spike could have occurred at any time. And since the time is the code, it's not clear that you have that kind of, you know, you don't have, the time has not been made discrete into bins. So no, I don't think there's any temporal aliasing. I don't know if anybody else knows of an example, but because there's no bins of the time. So it's a funny kind of code that if you think of it as the time, then it's a continuous variable. Okay, any other? All right, I just want to mention again, I'm not talking about this, but maybe somebody is. I just wanted to mention maps. Because another huge part, this is sort of my lightning review of systems neuroscience, of this is to, first of all, you measure the selectivity of the neurons, you see what they're responsive to, and what they're responsive to tends to define regions of the brain, you know, tend to be characterized by motion selective neurons over here, face selective neurons over here, things like that. But within these regions, you can look at the selectivity. For example, this is a map of which orientations the different neurons like. And the gray lines are isoorientation contours. So these are contours along which orientations seem to be similar. And for example, a pinwheel like this is a region of the cortex, this is a primary visual cortex, where the orientations go around it goes from 0 to 180, but it goes around half the circle as you go around like that. So looking at how the selectivities of neurons are mapped across the cortex is another huge area, both of theoretical and experimental study that I'm not going to talk about, but I thought I would mention it. Okay, so let me just quickly introduce, I guess, the mathematics that we're going to do in the afternoon, and then maybe we can do a break. Okay. Okay. So let me talk a little bit about the firing rates a little more mathematically and just showing you pictures of what we really mean. So we're all on the same page, kind of. And again, part of the problem with rate codes and temporal codes is that not everybody's, when they say firing rate, means the same thing. So A nicest way, if you want to characterize the fact that timing is everything and that the amplitudes of spikes don't really mean anything, then one way of characterizing, well, the simplest way of characterizing a neural response is to just list the times of those spikes. And that's what those little lines were in the things where I was showing you. So you just list all the spike times, let's say they're n spikes, give their timings, and that's it. That's the neural code. Everything, according to this sort of hypothesis that timing is everything, that's all you get from one neuron. Of course, I could list those from many different neurons, but out of that, you've got to get your perception of the world and everything. However, it's convenient to characterize this as really a bunch of pulses. And so often, a quantity that I like to call the neural response function is introduced, which is just a function that has delta functions at every spike. So it's the ultimate in spikes. So you just sum up over all the different spike times and have a delta function every time you have a spike, which is a nice way of characterizing one is that, at least as a theorist, you tend to think of these spikes as really occurring at an instant of time. Of course, they really do have a finite width. And the other is that they don't have any shape. I mean, it's just the delta function. There's no meaning in the shape, even though they do, of course, have a shape. So that's a complete description of the response of a neuron. If you do an experiment, you get n spikes, that's everything. Okay, but again, that's not a statistical measure. This will differ every time you do the experiment and things like that. And so in order to get around that, people do various things. For example, if you wanted to count the number of spikes, obviously, you could just integrate over the response function over the whole duration of the trial. So if the trial lasts from time 0 to t, and you just integrate this neural response function, then of course, because the delta function integrates to 1, you get n. And then you can define what many people call a firing rate, but we have to be a little bit careful. I'll call it a firing rate for now, but do it, is just by taking that number n and dividing by the time. So that's one measure of the firing rate. And I like to call that a spike count rate. It's not what I mean by a firing rate, what I've been talking about, but it is a definition of a firing rate. And let me just belabor the point a little bit, because I'm going to go somewhere with it, to say, okay, this can be written then as the average of the neural response function, okay, over the trial. So the firing rate that I want to talk about is a limit of this. Firing rate that really is the time-dependent firing rate is to look at the spikes within a narrow window, not over the whole trial like this. And so it really can be thought of as the limit, as delta t goes to 0, with the limit being sort of taken in a kind of a careful way, of an integral of this neural response function over a narrow window. But again, this will be subject, I've said something slightly out of order. This is going to be subject to variability. So in fact, what we really should do is then average this over trials. So I'm going to put in brackets, which means averaging that neural response function over many trials. So that's really what I mean by firing rate. So it really, of course, corresponds to these pictures, right? In other words, this represents counting how many spikes occurred in a bin of width delta t, averaging over all the whole trial, and then dividing by delta t. And then the limit is just formally, mathematically, of course, you're never really going to be able to do that with a finite data set. So that is what I want to call the firing rate. And it has one important property that's going to be useful for us. And that is that if you have an integral involving the neural response function, so for example, I'll tell you why I don't like to do that. It's delta functions, right? It's sort of a funny limit. So I'm trying to be more rigorous. What Misha's saying is that loosely this could be interpreted that the firing rate really is just the average of the neural response function, right? That's kind of what this looks like, because you say, well, look, you're integrating the integrals delta t, you divide by delta t. But I didn't do that because it's confusing, right? This is always delta functions. No matter how much you average it, it's always going to be delta functions. So if you did that, you'd have to make the delta functions a little bit fat, you know, not real delta functions, and do it that way. So I'd rather. So I don't want you to think of this way. But I'm about to do exactly what Misha had in mind. Namely, if you have an integral, we're going to involve in what I'm going to do very soon, we're going to see lots of integrals where you want to take some function and look at it at the times when spikes occurred. So you want to take it times the neural response function and do an integral like that, for example. It's like a weighted sum of spikes, right? Because remember, this is a set of delta functions. So what this ends up being is just a sum over all of the spikes of that function evaluated at actually t minus the time of the spike. So you can average a function over the spikes this way. And you'll see we're going to do this very soon. In fact, I'll be able to do that before lunch, and then I'll come back. Okay, because of this relationship, you can, within an integral, even though you really shouldn't write this, because there's no way a continuous function can be a sum of delta functions, within an integral, that's a possible replacement. So the real property of the firing rate that's very useful is that, well, again, if you average over trials, is that you can replace the neural response function by the firing rate as long as you work within integrals. Then the fact that it's delta functions doesn't matter. And so, if you want, in the back of your head, you can think of this replacement, that I can replace the firing rate with the average of the neural response function, but the only proviso is within integrals. Otherwise, you know, you're going to get a sum of delta functions. Okay, so let me tell you where this comes from, and also let me tell you where we're going, although we won't get there till after lunch. All right, so the idea is that this is the firing rate, and it's just intuitively what you think of. In particular, the critical property of it is that the probability of getting a spike within a narrow time bin of width delta t is the firing rate times delta t, okay? So it's, for small delta t, it acts like sort of like a probability density of spikes, but it's not a probability density, it's a rate. If you integrate it, you get the number of spikes. You don't get, you know, the total probability of finding a spike. Okay, so that's the firing rate. So where are we going? Where we're going is to try to make a model that allows us to go from stimulus to firing rate. So I want to be able to get a stimulus from an experimentalist or something and build a model that allows me to predict the firing rate that that neuron's going to do. So it's a model of the neuron, if you want. And within this map, the whole concept of things like receptive fields and selectivities is all built within that map. Although in neuroscience you don't really see it phrased that way, the whole structure of receptive fields is understood to exist within this framework. And in particular, I'm going to give you a review of the visual system where we'll see that all the properties, you know, orientation selectivity, spatial frequency selectivity, spatial phase selectivity, simple cells, complex cells, are all going to drop out from here. So if you have if you've seen the visual neuroscience but you have a physics background, it to me it was all very mysterious until I studied such models, and then it's like all obvious all of a sudden. So it's very useful to understand this framework that I'm working towards. Even though, as I say, in many of the neuroscience literature, it's kind of implicit; it doesn't actually appear. So that's where we're going towards, but we probably won't get there till after lunch. Okay, but I'm going to start off with something that's going to be related to this, but just do it in a sort of intuitively obvious manner. So, you know, if you're starting to think about this map from stimulus to response, somebody will give you a stimulus that they use, and, you know, say, here it is, it goes like this. And a response that they get. So maybe, you know, you get a spike there, a couple of spikes there, you know, something like that. You get some sort of response. And you're going to want to start thinking about the map between these. You know, what are we going to do? Let me tell you something about the stimulus before we start, so it'll help in the math, and then I'll get to this question. Although maybe, yeah. Now, the theories that I'm going to talk about are going to be either sort of linear or I guess what we could call kind of quasi-linear. I'll explain what that means. So we're actually going to look at linear maps within neuroscience, which would sound like it sounds like a stupid thing to do, maybe. What I want to show you, although, you know, sort of a well-hidden secret of neuroscience, is this works incredibly well for some neurons. It's really not a bad approximation. And again, if you're from a physics background or whatever, quantum, it gives you something to grab hold of to see a linear model work. So these are basically linear models. Now, in order to have a hope of a linear model working, you have to design the stimulus properly. And the main thing you have to worry about is adaptation. So almost all sensory neurons adapt. You know, if you go outside in the broad daylight as opposed to in a dark room, it isn't just your eyes that adapt, your pupils and like that. Your whole nervous visual system adapts to the changing not only light level, but contrast levels and things like that. And that's the way we can survive in an environment that's incredibly variable. Those adaptation effects are not going to be described by a linear model. And so the experimentalists often try to restrict their stimuli so they avoid the adaptation effects. And in the language we're going to use, we're going to do that by choosing stimuli whose average value are zero. Or if you want, whatever the stimulus is, the thing I'm going to call S is going to be its deviation from the mean. And then we're going to look at linear models between S, the deviation from the mean, and the firing rate. And there, you know, you have a hope of a linear model working. For example, you're almost guaranteed that if this is small enough, a linear model has to work, you know. And so you don't have to have the stimulus be small, you just have to have the fluctuations about its mean be small. So the first condition here is that if you integrate the stimulus, let's say average it over the trial, it's going to be zero. We're going to talk about the stimulus as being defined as the fluctuations about the mean. Okay, that was a bit of an aside. I won't use that immediately, but I'll use it eventually. All right, so first function I want to introduce is just sort of an intuitively obvious thing that you might do when you started thinking about this. And that is to say, well, look, this spike here, let's say we look at that spike, okay, and we come up to the thing. What caused that spike to happen? What about the stimulus caused it to happen? Well, clearly, it's got to be the part of the stimulus somewhat just before that spike. So that spike was presumably, you know, responding to maybe that part of the stimulus. It can't obviously have been caused by the stimulus in the future. That would be acausal. And it's unlikely that this bump had much of an effect to cause that spike. You know, neurons aren't going to remember things for a week. And so you think, well, okay, something about whatever occurred right here, that neuron responded to and made a spike. And so one thing that people will frequently start off with in a problem like this is what's called a spike-triggered average. In other words, every time you get a spike, you look at what the stimulus did just before the spike, or for a period of time before the spike. Now, because the responses are so variable, doing that for one spike isn't going to tell you a whole lot, but you do it again and again, and you average. So in other words, I'll pick spikes well separated so we don't do it. In this case, you'd take that stimulus, and then you'd look, you know, at that stimulus, and then for this spike here, you'd look at that stimulus. And of course, you would have overlapping ones, so for that, you know, for that spike there, you'd do, you know, this overlapping sort of stimulus. Anyway, you do it for every spike, and you average what you get, figuring that the variability will go away if you do that average, and that's what's called a spike-triggered average. So let's write down precisely what it is. I'm going to define it as C of tau, and tau here is the distance backwards in time that you're going to go. So remember, what you do is you take the time of a spike, and you look at the stimulus going backwards in time. Because of causality, you don't want to look forward in time. And so what you do is you take the stimulus at the time of a spike, so Ti is the time of the ice spike, and you look backwards in time by an amount tau. Okay? And then you average over all spikes. So you're going to sum here over all the spikes in the trial, and you're going to divide by the number of spikes. And that's what's called a spike-triggered average. It's obviously an intelligent thing to do, I think, if you just intuitively think about it. And it's going to be intimately linked to this problem in the end, in fact. Now, the only other thing that you might want to do in order to get your statistics better is to do this many, many times, okay? So show again this exact same stimulus, get another response, do it over and over again. And so, in fact, what we're going to do, again, these bars, these brackets, always for me, indicating averaging over an experiment with the same stimulus over and over again. So you just repeat exactly this, you'll get a slightly different spike train, and you'll do it again and again, and you just average. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
It seems to me that if you have a stimulus which is at some high black levels or something, it would cause spikes. But if it changes quickly, that would cause spikes.
That is frequently the case. That is correct, yeah. Well, not necessarily, because if that's the case, then C of T should show a big slope, right? You'll see that. In fact, I'll show you examples. You're going to see exactly what you say. That not only that, cells tend to like things that reverse, like, you know, black goes to white or something like that. But that'll show up here because you can do it. Now, you get into another problem that you can say, this is really a matter of how you define S. What is the cell responding to? Maybe it's really responding to the derivative, and therefore what I call S should really be the derivative of the light level or whatever. That's a whole different problem that I've skipped. Namely, what you define here to be your stimulus variable is obviously very critical, especially because we're aiming towards a linear theory. So if you, instead of using S of T, you use S of T to the 3/2 power times e to the minus S, it's not going to work, right? And so here is intuition. I don't have any mathematical insight into that. You have to have an intuition, just like what you said, about what you think the cell is responding to and what is going to provide you the most direct, hopefully linear link between those. So cleverly choosing S of T is critical in all this to work. Okay, well, we'll see. I mean, in principle, this could go back as far as you want, but presumably C is going to go to zero, right? Because if a neuron doesn't have a memory of a week. But I haven't committed. I mean, when I drew these little pictures, I didn't go back. But you can average all the way back as far as you like. But the C of T should, in fact, tell you about the memory, if you want, of the response. How far back in time does it depend? And it's going to be tend to be 50, 100 milliseconds. Yeah, right?
Just a technical question. So you're not limiting tau to be the spike interval?
No. Tau is any number from zero, really, to minus infinity, or, you know, to the... No, it's the stimulus, right? So in other words... Yeah, so in fact, but I mean, you raise a good point, that as I go back, I'm kind of ignoring the fact that that spike occurred. It has no effect. If that one hadn't appeared, I wouldn't change the thing. So this is, again, the thing. You could have a sort of a conditional sum, well, what if you did this? Or I'll talk about it later, but you could have a spike-triggered average conditional on two spikes or three spikes as well, but this one doesn't do that. Did you have another? Yeah, okay. I'll come back to that, I think, when I do this. Right. That's right. Now, but again, you don't have to worry, because anything, for example, let's say you did an example where S of T was an auditory signal, but this was a visual neuron. Then you're going to just get zero here, right? Because it just won't correlate. And so it'll all take care of itself. You do something stupid, it should take care of itself. Okay. Now, for kind of mathematical niceties, It's usually assumed here that if n is very large, basically what I want to do is replace this by this. To n. okay? Which is okay. I mean, if n is very large, the number of spikes is very large, then the average value of n and the individual values of n in every trial aren't that different. And so most people, when they define the spectrogram average, actually mathematically they do this, but most people when they do experiments, they actually measure this one. So there's a little bit of slight discrepancy between the math and the experiments, but we're going to ignore that by assuming n is so big that it doesn't matter. Okay, so let me play with this a little bit, and then I'll finish up. So let's write this first in terms of the neural response function, and then in terms of the firing rate. So remember what the neural response function was. It was just a sum of delta functions on every single spike. And so it's clearly exactly designed for doing sums like this, right? Because every time you have a delta function, you're gonna get a spike. So in fact, the neural response function, this spike-triggered average, you can write it as 1 over the average value of n, the integral over the whole trial of rho of, just trying to remember to see in my notes, you can by shifting the integration variable, you can write it in two ways, and I just want to see how I wrote it so I don't get screwed up later. So I wrote it like this. Rho of t, s of t minus tau. Okay? So in other words, the rho is going to fire a delta function every time there's a spike, and that's going to replace that t with a ti, and then since it's the sum of delta functions, I'm going to get this. The only thing is, I have to average over trials, right? I haven't done that yet. But the average over trials, the stimulus is the same on every trial. So the average over trials just does this. Just means you're supposed to use the average neural response function. So that's just another way of writing. That's an exact mathematical identity. But now, I can use the fact that the neural response function, which is kind of an ugly beast to worry about, to work with, within integrals, the average of this neural response function can be replaced by the firing rate. So what you get here is 1 over the average number of spikes, the integral over time of the firing rate at time t times the stimulus at time tau earlier. So not surprisingly, right? It's a correlation between how likely are you to fire a spike given, you know, the correlation with that, with the stimulus slightly earlier in time or whatever, tau earlier in time. And this is a quantity it has another name, namely the stimulus, the response stimulus correlation function, okay? This is obviously a correlation, is defined in this way. It's just the average value over the duration of the trial of the correlation of the firing rate with the stimulus, only it's defined with a plus just because of the way it's defined. So this is the response stimulus, or if you want, a correlation function defined that way. And just by comparing the two, you can see what the relationship is. Okay? This has to be multiplied by t and divided by n. So in fact, what it ends up being is the response stimulus correlation function. But you notice that this has a plus tau and this has a minus tau. So evaluated at minus tau, divided by the average firing rate of the neuron. Yeah?
What is t?
T is the duration of the experiment. I could write it as infinity, but as just for the average, okay? So it's the whole, it's just integrating with whole experiments. So as a result of this relationship here, the methods I'm talking about are often called reverse correlations. The reverse is this minus sign. And so sometimes the spike-triggered average is also called the reverse correlation of the thing because, again, of this minus sign. But at any rate, we're going to use that. Maybe I'll write that over here and we'll save it till later. So the spike-triggered average is this, and it's related to this correlation function by this relation. And the reason I'm doing all this is because when we work out this, this correlation function is going to come up again, and now this relationship will allow us to relate it to the spike-triggered average. So, enormous amount of work has been done in characterizing, in particular the visual system, but other systems as well, in terms of these spike-triggered average functions. And they obviously tell you something interesting about the nature of the sensitivity of the neuron. It's sort of, what does the neuron want to see before it spikes? Now, for reasons that should be obvious, I'm going to plot, I'll show you some of these, then we can quit, I guess. I like to plot these backwards, basically. So you want to plot C of tau. Normally, you know, the tau axis would go that way. But remember that tau is reflecting how far back in time are you looking. And so it's actually kind of more instructive to plot them with the axis flipped backwards. And plot, you know, here's, you know, 50 milliseconds, 100 milliseconds, whatever, and they're going to be, you know, various things that look like that. Because although C of T you read out that way, the kind of stimulus that the neuron likes you would read out this way. You know, the stimulus is occurring like this, and then bam, a spike is occurring. That's the way to think of it. So I'm always going to plot them flip backwards, because I think it's easier to interpret. And let me just show you a couple of them. And then maybe we can call it a day. Call it a morning, not a day. You're not off the hook yet. This is just a nice... did I do something bad or something? Or is this a light? Okay. This is just a plot from the Spikes book, you know, of showing this... showing this method, and it's kind of a nice plot. So in this case, they have a stimulus that's made out of little square pulses, and they've just showed you the spike-triggered average. So every time there's a spike, here are the spikes of the neuron. Every time the spikes, they've drawn a gray box, and they've made it over here, three gray boxes, and then they average all those, and they get some blip. So that's just basically the process. And, you know, if you, I don't know if people run, like, models while they're here and do that? Because, you know, an instructive thing to do is to build a simple, like an integrated fire, simple neuron model, feed it a stimulus, and do a spike-triggered average. In fact, do the whole process that I'm going to talk about, then try to describe its firing rate in terms of a kernel, like I'm going to say. Okay, so this is a real example. This is from work of Gabbiani and Koch and somebody else. I should have written down the reference, sorry. And it's an example from electric fish. So this is an organ in the electric fish, or a neuron in the electric fish, that's sensitive to electric fields around the fish. So what they've done here is the stimulus consists of them putting some electrodes in the water and manipulating the electric fields around the fish. So that's this. This is a measure of the voltage that they're applying in a complex pattern. They record the spikes. So here are the spikes coming from this neuron, which is, as I said, sensitive to electric fields. And then here is their spike-triggered average. And this comes back to what you were saying, that if you notice what this particular neuron, you know, kind of likes to fire to, if you can use that language, is downward, is negative potentials, but ones that follow a rapid change. And this is completely typical. Neurons like to fire on changing stimuli, not on stimuli, let's say, that are just big. Obviously, so it likes large negative potentials, but in particular, after there's been a reversal. So the best, you know, the typical response is a positive swing followed by a negative swing. Now, of course, that probably never occurred in here, but that's the average that you get. So there's a typical example. And I'm going to show you after lunch a whole bunch of examples of this from the visual system. So you can take a neuron in the visual system, show stimuli that are complex, you know, like this, only now they're going to be visual stimuli, and then look at this spike-triggered average response, and it tells you a great deal about the selectivity of the neuron. And the whole visual, you know, primary visual cortex literature is just filled with descriptions of those spike-triggered averages, even though they'll never let you know that. That's what they are. So maybe we'll quit and we'll come back to do that. And I'll do the mathematics of relating this to predicting firing rates.